You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this next hour of the Made of Clay Report is Teresa Ault.
Hello.
Welcome, Teresa.
Hello.
I am glad that you could be here with us this morning, and you are a WRFI volunteer with your WRFI shirt on.
Yes.
And that's a part of your life, but your life is much more than that.
Oh, yes.
So what I'd like you to do is just start with our opening question, which is, who are you? And take it however you want.
Okay. Well, I think in a word, I would say now, I am a socialist,
mm-hmm.
and that's a pretty complex thing. It's much more, and socialism is really much more an aspiration than anything that can be neatly defined. It's the idea of bringing democracy, bringing solidarity, people mm-hmm. cooperating with one another, liking one another, well, not necessarily liking one another, but understanding that their fates are linked and they will work together.
Right.
And it kind of creates a warm feeling, I find, mm-hmm. to be working together with other people.
Solidarity.
Yes. I think that is really a key word. For me, that is a very key word in mm-hmm. all this. Mm-hmm. And I guess I should just say with caution, there are people who, you know, there are socialists for whom it probably looks rather different.
Right.
This is... You know, that no more defines something in a simple way than if somebody says, I am a Christian. It completely doesn't define them.
Absolutely.
You have to start asking all the questions.
Yes. I have learned that there's often more variation within a group than there are across groups, because many of the formative conflicts in any one group extend to all the socialists or Christians or whatever. They
right.
all have the same internal conflicts and values issues and
right.
prejudices
or
and stuff.
Perhaps different conflicts.
Well, and sometimes different. Yeah. But it's rich inside. And
right.
Sometimes, yeah.
Rich inside. And then I think also what we often find is large but incomplete areas of agreement with people who are outside,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
where there may be extensive operative similarities, mm-hmm. making it very possible to work together. And again, that's a key thing. And yet, people can work together who have completely different philosophical
underpinnings. So let me just try to reframe what you said. I don't know if it'll be any simpler. We can fail to see the profound similarities in others just across the way from us, where we're operating, and then we can sometimes work with people who we share very little, but we can find a very functional, practical way to make common cause.
Right, right.
Yeah. That's very powerful. Well, I hope over the course of this hour, we're going to come to know, I hope, how you've come to this place. But is there anything more you want to say with respect to the question, who are you?
Who am I? Okay, I'll cheat a little bit because I know what song you're going to play.
Sure, and you can introduce it.
I will. And I picked this song because it sort of pays homage to my, you might say, Central European German language heritage. You know, it's a song I've known for a very long time. I can't remember when I first heard it.
Right. And do you want to say, and what's the name?
Die Gedanken sind frei. Thoughts are free.
Thoughts are free. And it speaks to a quality of the human mind that has been celebrated for an eternity, from the very beginning.
Right.
But sometimes in this world where we try to make things into property, it gets lost, or privilege.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Good. Okay. I'm going to start that. Do you want to say anything more about it before we go there?
No, it's a traditional German and Austrian song.
Yeah. Okay. Here we go.
Gedanken sind frei, wer kann sie erwarten? Sie fliegen vorbei wie nächtliche Schatten. Kein Mensch kann sie wissen, kein Jäger erschießen mit Pulver und Blei. Die Gedanken sind frei. Ich denke, was ich will und was mich beglückt, doch alles in der Stille. Und wie es sich schickt,
Song reminds us that thoughts are free, and as we were doing the introductory comments here and you were talking about socialism and singing the song of kind of relationship and collaboration and equality, I was thinking back to my rural Missouri roots, and I'm probably more German than anything else, though German and Scottish are the two, and my German ancestors spoke German in the home for 150 years in the U.S., and they gave it up in World War I because it was kind of no longer couth to do so. But the roots were in rural cooperativism and Christian anarchism, which we don't even know anything about now in contemporary America, because this was the indigenous version of socialism was called cooperativism, and it was rural, it wasn't urban. And people would help each other out across their differences, and they would make common cause, but you didn't have to share a whole lot except a commitment to look after your after the other. And anarchy was the absence of a head, a single central organizer. Principle so that everybody could cooperate by consent. So it assumed that society could move forward by each of us consenting to what we were doing. And that was not anarchy as irresponsible behavior, but anarchy as deeply responsible behavior. So those are the words that come not out of a European tradition. Socialism is much stronger out of that tradition, but that's my rural roots going back, you know, 5-6 generations.
That's interesting. So that is a kind of solidarity and cooperation.
Absolutely.
That is rather spontaneous and not very rule-driven, I guess.
No. And it's all about the free thoughts. I mean, the reason that this song, you know, Thoughts Are Free, these are people who believe that they could make the world that they would live in.
Uh-huh.
And that flies in the face of determinism or institutions in many ways.
Right. And I guess it also... you have to say requires a lot of that you have some space around you.
You have to have an ego.
Yeah.
That allows, you don't have to have physical space around it, although bad on the rural areas you did, but you had to have an ego which was defined so that other people could have space around you to have their own agendas and their own egos, and you could work together rather than making each other the
right.
same.
Well, I think actually where a lot of people live close together, one finds that there are some very practical limitations.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we see that when one person wants to build a tall house and the neighbor says, no, you're going to put my house in a shadow.
Right. Yeah.
You know, that's...
To work it out. Yeah, you have to be able to
consent. You have to work
consent.
It out, and it comes from, you know, from being close together.
Right. But then you find other ways to express yourself or to...
Sure.
So you limit one, and then that's it. But you were going to say a little more about the song, and I...
Oh, I just wanted to say, if anybody was listening and knows German, but isn't familiar, terribly familiar with the song, he would say, wait a minute, that's not a political song. That's a song about women and wine. And I think the point is there's a verse about that. And there seem the various folk who sang this song seem to have had some very different ideas, whether those free thoughts were political or religious or about, you know, other people, you know, their object of attachment.
Right, and the way that I read it was that we have relationships that are based on love and on necessity and not based, I mean, that we're not told what to do, but we choose.
But I think it's a mistake to try to make the song into too much of a rational unit.
Political, sure, absolutely.
It picked up some very different verses along the way.
I bet it did. Was it? Okay. So you're listening to WRFI Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Teresa Ault. And Teresa, so tell me about what sorts of experiences have helped to shape you and to shape your life.
I think what's really essential is that there were some greatly contrasting experiences. Mm-hmm. When I was young, the family, relatively recent arrivals who had fled the Holocaust in Austria, mm-hmm. Came to the United States, well educated, but no money.
Right, right.
So grew up, you know, in a rather small, plain house with a lot of discipline around spending.
A lot of fear, I imagine, around that too, or concern.
Maybe less fear because by the time I was old enough to know anything, my father had a civil service job.
Right, so and discipline oftentimes is a good way to avoid fear.
Yeah.
And you're correct.
And yes, and exactly, discipline. Simply, you have money and you put some of it in the bank.
Right.
You get some more, you get the next paycheck, some of it goes into the bank.
And you don't have to think about it all the time because you know what you're doing.
Yeah, you know what you're doing, but on the other hand, if you just, you know, I mean, certainly I remember as a child, I wanted this, I wanted that. No, mm-hmm. I could not have it.
Right.
So that was part of it. And also very much the idea that by hard, diligent work, one could move ahead. And that was both a family idea and even more so, I think, an idea in the surrounding society. Mm-hmm. Well, I worked very hard academically, went to an elite college, got my AB, went to graduate school, got a PhD in Slavic linguistics.
You're really looking for the employment opportunities and, there.
Yes, it was supposed to mean guaranteed employment. Uh-huh, uh-huh. If you put up with the work, you have a job.
Right.
And turned out there was no job at the end of it.
Right.
Only some very temporary jobs that, as I look back, I was a very early adjunct.
Yes. Yep. Yep.
So you might say the work I did had completely fallen apart, and I took a job in Olin Library up at Cornell, and that was quite something of an eye opener because we were those of us, you know, at the bottom level were considered stupid. Uh-huh. And you know, we're treated as if we were stupid, in a certain sense, learned that we had to act as if we were.
Right.
And yet I knew that it wasn't true in my case mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. I had, you know, accomplished a number of things along the way. And it just really brought it home to me that that meritocracy that we supposedly think about is not operating in the United States.
Right. Was this in the 1970s?
Yes.
Yeah.
Late 70s.
Yeah. That was before doctorates were, there was just as doctorates were becoming almost a dime a dozen in mm-hmm. Ithaca who were doing mm-hmm. something other than mm-hmm. what they studied.
Yeah.
I came to Cornell in 1976 from rural poverty and had 1 foot in poverty and 1 foot in the privilege of Cornell. Uh-huh. And I had more in common with the housekeepers and the janitorial staff than I had with the students. And though I'm very verbal and I'm very outgoing, uh-huh. so I could make up for it,
uh-huh.
but I didn't feel at home.
I see.
In part was because what I was sensing in terms of some of those treatments and assumptions, because I knew poor people who were really smart, and they wouldn't tolerate being looked down upon because, you know, that wasn't acceptable. And yet I sensed that role, and I gave up an accent because I used to talk a lot more with more nasality and a bit of a Midwestern accent. And in order to survive at Cornell, uh-huh. I had to give it up. You know, so I'm sensing a
right.
similar sort of thing. How did you navigate that personal space?
Well, I think it's pretty simple. At that point, Okay, leave aside.
It's not so simple for some people.
leave aside a few, joining my partner, going abroad for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. But I joined a group called the Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee, mm-hmm. which a few years later merged with another group, the New American Movement, and mm-hmm. became Democratic Socialists of America in 1981-82.
Right.
So in other words, my determination was, we'll have to work on changing things.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that became a very clear, it's not, I will have to find a way to get ahead in this society.
Have to work on changing things.
Yeah, yeah, that was the big decision.
When I came from this very Christian, rural, Christian anarchist kind of background, which I they wouldn't use the label themselves because especially now that would be offensive terms. I come from a town that had a woman mayor in 1922, and she was an elder. I mean, she was an older woman in the church. She was already old. I mean, she was in her 60s when I was born. So anyway, I knew her in the later part of her life. But these were strong stock people, and she couldn't be an elder in the congregation because she was a woman, and that was the discrimination. Uh-huh. She could be mayor of King City, but she couldn't be an elder in the congregation. But she said, they will never meet without me. And the elders never met without her because she was an attorney. She was had membership in the bar and was an attorney. She'd been the postmistress of King City for a number of years in the 1910s. And she had that kind of chutzpah. But people who believe themselves to be equal and they're not going to take any guff do that. Now, that's what I came from. I came to Cornell, and it was a very different sort of place to be.
I see.
And the point of this is that I think I've almost lost the point of this because your story was in. Oh, when I came to Cornell, I tried to find a place to be with other people who shared similar values.
Uh-huh.
And I went to Cornell United Religious Work, to the different Christian, Protestant, Catholic. I went to Jewish services because lots of my new friends were Jewish. And then I said, this isn't quite working for me. And what was CRESP at that time was all about social justice and all this kind of organizing mm-hmm. and all this kind of, but it was all self-righteous to me. It didn't sound reflective, so it wasn't deeply personal. But I started to attend the Democratic Socialist
meetings. Really?
Yeah, yeah. And there I found people who talked about the personal and the public.
Uh-huh.
And the personal, community, private, public, all in one sentence or in one breath, so that it all came to hold together. So that's where I found a home. But then I graduated in 81 and moved on. But that was similar, that feel. So I want to say that I know, and I think there are some underlying sympathies in this culture with what
right.
you have described.
But now how come we don't remember each other?
Well, I don't know, because I wasn't really active. I was being an undergraduate and living.
When did you start?
I started in 76, and I took a leave of absence in 78, 79, and I finished in 81.
Okay. No, I mean, this 76 when you started?
Yes.
With,
yeah.
We have to get together sometime, and I have to ask you about everything you remember, because it bugs me that I'm missing the early history of this group.
And I'm not going to be good for that because I attended the meetings as kind of an observer dipping my toe in, looking for a place to be.
Oh, I see.
But uh-huh. I found it, but I couldn't sustain it. Now, I believe that there was a Turkish man, Erhan Kudeki, who may have been part of that group.
Never heard that.
Okay,
name.
So but he was part of a Turkish group of socialists and that anyway.
Yeah.
So these histories are complex and overlapping.
Oh sure, yeah. Sure.
So I digress, and I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay. No, but it's interesting. But, well, I still think we may be able to sort of talk about a time and. If only I come out of it with a name of someone I can talk to.
Right. And I could try, but we'll see. Yeah. Now, documenting the history of that has become important to you. And why is that?
I don't know. I take it for granted that one wants to document history.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah. I do too. I mean,
and there is a certain sense that I have a certain responsibility here because I know some of the old paper. I have some of the old documents, you know, grabbed when they would have gone into the trash.
Right. The ephemera that so much of history exists in.
And I know that there are people who want to see that kind of thing. What I don't know is. Where to put it,
right.
So that they could find it when they want it.
Right. I have some ideas on that, but that's a different conversation for not on air, or not necessarily to fill the airtime with. So you came here to do your doctorate here?
No.
So what brought you here?
Wales Brown.
Aha.
Now my husband.
Yes.
I came when I came, I had already defended my thesis. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I still needed to revise it and type it, which doesn't sound like much today, but in the pre-computer age was massive.
Yes. And if you could possibly hire somebody else to do it, you did, but it was a lot.
I tried and that failed. Mm.
Because of the language issue, I would imagine, no?
Partly, I think, bad luck getting somebody who maybe would have been capable but wasn't lost interest or something like that. Right. So it was a real mess where I started typing myself and then handed it over to somebody else, which meant starting over again, and then kind of having to take what she did and completely correct it. So it's like it started three times.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So in Ithaca, how has your life evolved from those roots? I think I remember you with Ben Nichols.
Oh, yes.
When he was mayor, you were on his staff, right?
Or no? Right, yes. Right. I was his administrative assistant. Yeah. Well, to take one step back from that kind of point in the very early 80s, as I said, where I decided that it was going to be necessary to change things. There was a second, you might say, gradual decision, major decision that I made, which was that I would not pursue my academic career. For many, many years, I clung to the idea that somehow I would make something out of it, maybe even as a translator. Mm-hmm. That's something I like to do. And I have often said that if we had had a single-payer healthcare system, I would have become a translator.
Because you wouldn't have needed the insurance.
Because I wouldn't have needed health insurance. Right. But to get health insurance, I reached the age of 40 and decided it's not safe to live without health insurance.
Right.
Looking
right.
back, I could have gotten away with it.
Right, but you can't.
You don't know that. Yeah. And it just seemed the responsible thing was to take a secretarial job at Cornell. So I worked as a secretary in the geology department for 6 years. And when I left work at 5 o'clock, I would metaphorically step into a phone booth and change and became the activist, the political activist. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And after 6 years, again, skipping over a lot of the details,
sure,
what it led to was becoming administrative assistant to Ben Nichols, mm-hmm, who had just become mayor,
right,
after a campaign that, you know, I had...
Had organized, had been had the organizer.
Had been part. Instrumental in.
Sure, sure, sure. I want to ask, because this is... this is well trod on some level, but not well trod. You got your doctorate at a time when many more women were getting doctorates, even though they were probably still a significant minority. But you were also put in the position of force to kind of choose on pursuing your career versus not. How did that, in terms of your... Were you just pragmatically moving on to the next thing, or how did you reflect on that? How did you and you put that in perspective as you were living through it?
I guess I would say messily.
Mm-hmm. No,
slowly.
We all of these things we do,
yeah,
messy and slowly.
Slowly,
yeah,
and
yeah,
messily. I mean, one thing that there was one incident along the way was there was, I think it was called the Cornell 11.
Yes.
Several women who sued Cornell. And it happened that at about that time, I looked into the statistics for Slavic. And it was pretty clear in the statistics that a lot of women were getting PhDs, and they were not getting the full-time jobs. So, you know, I mean, and one thing that did was that it became clear that it wasn't just me, it was a mm-hmm. big picture. And I think the sense that, well, you know what, if you have a job that ends at 5 o'clock, you can do other things in addition. I mm-hmm. think that mm-hmm. was a mm-hmm. factor. I mean, I can certainly say that I never came to a point where I had a good offer and turned it down.
Mm-hmm.
It was also a matter of rejection after rejection after rejection,
right,
and just finding I didn't think I could really handle that.
Right. It wears you down at a certain point.
It
you don't
wears,
want to go for it.
It wore me down after, I don't know, 50 or 100 or
yeah.
so.
Yeah. No, it would have worn me down way earlier than that.
Well, I mean, that a little bit that depends on what you count as rejection.
Yeah, yeah,
you
no,
know,
I know, I know.
You know,
I know.
How
yeah,
far
yeah.
did you get? Did
right.
you, but... you know, lots of unanswered applications.
So, Teresa, you brought... I want to just change subjects
yeah.
now and take a music break. What
okay.
would you like to go to next? I found an MLK chorus singing, a high school chorus singing We Shall Overcome.
Okay.
And I found
I think that's...
the solid. We have the Solidarity piece and the International.
Yeah.
So which would you like to go to next?
Well, let's play We Shall Overcome.
Okay, very good.
Oh, keep in mind.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and I'm your host, Eric Clay, and our guest on this hour is Teresa Ault. And there was an anthem that went with the civil rights movement. And
I just thought it was worth playing because actually at the late in high school and early in my undergraduate years, I was involved, you know, in a just sort of turning out for demonstration after demonstration mm-hmm. in the civil rights movement.
Where were you living at the time?
Well, I went to high school in Silver Spring, Maryland, mm-hmm. so it was the D.C. area, and to college near Philadelphia, so it was Philadelphia. Yeah. And I never did anything particularly dramatic or wonderful. A lot of demonstrating, a lot of mm-hmm. typing.
Mm-hmm. But it also, I mean, it's in keeping with this style of living the commitment in a low-key, steady way.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah,
and that's very powerful. Yeah. Yeah. So you made reference while we were off air that there was a second experience that you might want to talk to that has changed your life, that has shaped your life.
Okay, yes. I mean, one, and it kind of has two parts. One part is living with a professor for many years, mm-hmm. someone who has now worked at Cornell for more than 40 years at Cornell and more academic work before that. And that actually leads to a very financially secure situation, mm-hmm. Especially in retrospect, you know, earlier on, well, something could change, but it didn't.
Right.
Secondly, at a couple of points, but especially late in life, inheriting some money. Mm-hmm. And that sort of put the other half of that picture together. What I worked for, I never got. What I got, I never worked for.
That is powerful. Yeah. Yeah. And what do you take from that?
It's just a second angle on how messed up the capitalist system is, because capitalism does not reward work. Mm-hmm. It mm-hmm. rewards ownership. And that ownership can come about through accident, and it can even come about through misdeeds, mm-hmm. but not necessarily. But just the idea that it would so, to me, even that it would just so reward accident is unhealthy.
Right. Rather than protect people from accidents in another sense.
Right.
And that raises the question of how much can we set up a system that predicts what we will need, and how much do we need to improvise as we go along? Now, the reactionary knee-jerk claim for capitalism is that it's constantly destroying itself and reinventing itself. That's the corresponding kind of right-wing claim against socialism. It's too rigid. It's too ossified. Things don't happen. People don't maintain productivity and adaptability over the long haul. But I sense you're going to have a very different take on that.
Right. Well, one of the things is that, in a sense, you could say this kind of, you know, a pure entrepreneurial capitalism rewards irresponsibility. Mm-hmm. The idea that somebody would strike out in a new business without any thought for providing for his or her family. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Not a good idea. On the other hand, if you have, for instance, universal health care, a good disability system, perhaps child care provided, then indeed people can experiment with the work they do, perhaps go through a period of bringing in very little money, mm-hmm. but without, you know, subjecting their child
right.
to
to the possibility of not having what they needed and not having them around.
Right.
And one of the things that I think when I was an undergrad, this was a very popular topic, was that the whole capitalist system depended upon the fact that there were certain categories of labor that were unpaid for, such as women's labor or certain kinds of men's labor that was never really calculated into the value of things, and somehow they supported this. And it's in Marxist terms, it's the processes of reproduction versus the processes of production.
Right.
And I've always been most interested in those things that have almost never been adequately transferred into paid labor, because they're very hard to quantify, but we need them very much them for a good whole life.
And I think there, at least my socialist attitude would be, we should not try to turn everything into something that can be bought and sold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that may be the most basic thing.
Right. And I think that's a mirror we can hold up to people who want to make markets out of everything, mm-hmm. and to people who want to socialize everything in terms of formal commodities. Which has been one of the downfalls of socialism too.
When you turn it all into something to be bought and sold
and distributed, yes. And all that changes is the measure of equity for distribution rather than the appreciation of the full life.
But I think you do want. I think I would honor the term safety net.
Yes. No. I would more than honor the term safety net.
There should be things where a person simply doesn't fall and hit bottom, like needing medical attention,
and not being able to get
it. Yeah, I mean, one should be able to get it. And again, it's probably something that just does better when it isn't bought and sold, on the whole.
Right. As long as it is evaluated, assessed, and challenged to keep people honest about current practices and to keep people honest about... Because there are a lot of people who can receive less than adequate medical care and feel really good about it because the provider treated them really well. Older women fall into that category. If they have a doctor who treats them with great respect and deference, they will oftentimes feel they've been well cared for, but they may not have been properly treated.
Right. Although some of that, I think, actually starts getting into... we sometimes overestimate what medicine knows.
That's exactly... There's that, too.
So, you know, you can say skeptically a doctor who defers to the patient, but you could also say a doctor who listens to the patient.
And doesn't necessarily know what's going on.
And that can be much more important, than somebody who can read a few numbers and conclude.
And tell you statistically what the best procedure would be for you.
And not
really listen to you.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So some of this, I think, really, really... isn't all that well known.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There are areas where medicine knows stuff fantastically.
Right, and the evidence is very good for it, but I've heard it said that maybe a third to a half of what doctors do, they actually have any evidence, really solid research-based evidence to support. But it's less than half. And because they're working on experience, they're working on all sorts of stuff, and they're listening to the and negotiating with the patient what the patient's willing to do.
Well, yes, sure.
Yeah.
So that's important.
Mm-hmm. What I want to switch just a second here. You have been an activist in this community for 45 years.
Not quite. Let's say since about 1980.
Okay.
So that's 35.
So 35 years. How have you changed? How has this community changed? You know, what is a problem now that you weren't aware of back when you started? There are very few people who have the continuity of service that you do.
Yeah. How have I changed? Well, one thing that I am, I guess, in a way amazed at is the extent to which I have gotten involved with technology.
Mm-hmm.
Computers, then video, and now radio. And I think I would never have expected that earlier in my life. I am also, the idea that I'm here talking on radio I think that I couldn't have imagined that back in 1980.
Why?
Well, I was shy. Mm-hmm. Let's put it that way.
No. That's what I would have guessed. I didn't want to have to say that because I wanted. And humble in some on some level, but also committed and going to go over the
And what has changed? Well, I think the most enormous change is climate change. Mm-hmm. That, I mean, yes, long ago we were starting to worry that. Well, we worried about overpopulation, which has actually, I think, turned out to be a less serious problem than anticipated, mainly because, to the surprise of all sorts of experts, it turned out that women were quite willing to have fewer children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But also the carrying capacity of land and the productivity of agriculture, whether you care for the technology of agriculture or not, has proven to keep up.
Right.
In general.
Right. That too. We might have worried back in quite some decades ago about whether there would be enough fossil fuel last, but now we have come to the new realization that, in fact, there's quite a bit of fossil fuel, and the important thing is not to use it.
Right, to leave it. Yes. And how does that change your way of operating as an activist? How have these changes affected the way you operate?
There's something that I'm not really thinking of, but I would say it doesn't particularly change the way I operate, except sort of, you might say, around the edges. Mm-hmm. I mean, for instance, I have gotten, in the context of DSA, I have gotten quite involved in you might say, producing, that's a bit too pretentious a term, but doing helping others to do webinars, which means that people can communicate and learn at a distance, and you don't have to have everybody jumping into their cars and driving to a central point. You can disperse it over the internet. And actually, there are many reasons for doing that. It's easier on people's schedules.
Right.
It costs less. But also, you're using a very small amount of electrical energy rather than a lot of gasoline.
Right. And I guess one of the things that I have watched, partly because I'm one of these people with a PhD who doesn't use it, I don't use it in quite the way it was intended. But I have watched the issues around population and commuting in Tompkins County for the past 25 years when I came here to do the doctorate. And in the mid 80s, we banned the building of any new trailer parks, and we really made it harder to build housing in Tompkins County. And that's when the ratio of people commuting in began to just go off the charts.
Yes.
And before that, it was relatively close, maybe 5,000 in commuters and 5,000 in commuters, 2,500 out commuters. But now it's more like, depending upon who does the numbers, 15 to 20,000 in commuters, almost a third of, or 30% of our, not a third, but 30%, 25 to 30% of our workforce commutes in from outside the county, many just beyond the boundaries because they can't find housing here, and they're working for jobs that are in the $8 to $15, $8 to $20 an hour range, which is very hard to find housing here. That seems like a climate issue in terms of getting those people in the county so they don't have to commute, or at least they have the option.
I agree,
but it's not one that's gotten a lot of playtime, a lot of airtime in the activist community. But it seems solidly important.
Well, it's gotten some. I mean, there were some, for instance, when recently this project on Hancock Street that INHS has proposed, and there has been quite, well, there is a big controversy around it, yeah, with a lot of neighbors saying it's too big, and a lot of other people saying affordable housing is really important.
Right. And from my point of view, it could possibly be even a little bigger and still be suitable, and many of the new buildings built could have been a little bit bigger, from my point of view, in order to increase the housing stock. But so, yeah, no, I understand. You know,
and we're having something of the same issue playing out on the old library site, although there are several confounding factors there that...
Yeah. And I threw, and I've been active on the lifelong confounding factor there, because that is a group that needs to get its feet firmly planted on the ground. But both of the proposals that are front runners have serious weaknesses. So,
yeah, as I say, you can't really, too many confounding factors. Yeah, yeah. You can't really make a grand argument of principle on that one.
Right. Where would you like to see, where are your efforts going locally, and where are your efforts going now? You talked about these webinars and things that you're helping. Mm-hmm. What issues are you taking on in your life now?
Locally?
Locally. And we'll go to the others later. Yeah.
I think living wages, mm-hmm, is a big one. However, we are going to try to get there, whether by a local minimum wage that's a living wage, or by on a more case-by-case basis. Mm-hmm. I would really like to see more people going into cooperatives, mm-hmm, worker cooperatives, more development of worker cooperatives. It's that one I haven't quite figured out if there's a good way to, for somebody who's retired, to promote that.
Right, right, right. Well, I have one may seem totally tangential thought on that. Let me take let me first talk about the minimum wage piece. I think this is a political moment where the $15 an hour minimum wage is something which is politically viable in a way that it hasn't been. When I realized that I was working in 1970 at the age of 11 and 12 and getting a dollar an hour, that was worth $15 an hour now, because that was the minimum wage back then, or close to 15. I made what my mother made working for the minimum wage, and I kept some of it. We pooled some of it. That's how, mm-hmm, we got by. The idea that it dropped in value so far shocked me, because I didn't realize it until a few years, mm-hmm, ago when I said, oh, my mom and I could, and we could live on some survivor's benefits from my dad's death, mm-hmm, and minimum wage. We could actually make that work. And you can't when it's worth half of what it was then,
right,
or less,
right,
than half. And so that was a major opening thing for me. So I wish you well on that particular effort.
Thank you.
But also the piece, sorry, I just dropped the point. Yeah.
Well, I have another point that has occurred to me that's become very current. Issues of parking.
But you were talking about, there was another issue that I was slipping in the minimum wage piece. There was something you talked about after the minimum wage piece that seemed...
After the minimum wage piece? I don't think so. I think I said cooperatives, worker cooperatives.
Cooperatives. And I think what we What takes down a lot of cooperatives, at least it did in my father's setting when he was getting a cooperative among farmers to buy, mm-hmm, equipment together and stuff before he died, was that with cooperatives, there needs to be a really transparent process and skill at living with conflict. Mm-hmm. Because cooperatives are highly conflictual settings, and most of us are not equipped emotionally, mm-hmm, to deal with that conflict, and also to bring new people into it and let people go,
right,
so that it has this generational quality.
Right.
So
right.
I think a person in, you said, what can an older person do, a retired person do? I think modeling or encouraging people to become more adept at living, uh-huh, within conflict, which is something that if you haven't figured out by the time you're retired, you know, you're not going to figure it out.
Well, I'm not sure that I've figured it out.
But at least having the glint in your eye that you have,
right,
means that you know that you can survive it.
Yeah.
And that's a lesson that a lot of people, mm-hmm, don't trust.
Mm-hmm. Well, on on the issue of how people can learn to deal with conflict in cooperatives, I think it may be more useful to look at a small number of well-working ones, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, and then see what one, you know, what makes them work. Mm-hmm. There's a network of bakeries in, mm-hmm, the Bay Area of California, the Arizmendi bakeries, mm-hmm, that seem to have found a good way to work. There's actually somebody in this community who has worked in them.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And I think that may be a key.
That's a part of bringing the knowledge in.
Yeah. Bringing the knowledge in from where there was experience in a much more relevant. First of all, remember, a worker cooperative is one structure. Mm-hmm. A buying cooperative is a rather different structure.
Yes, absolutely.
It's not, you know, it may be that the techniques would transfer, and it may be that they wouldn't.
Right,
I don't
know. And I've known people, and I've known both types of firms, and the rural cooperatives tended to be both. They would share labor as well as the purchasing stuff, but they would own it separately. The sharing of labor was much more on an informal basis.
Right.
So you had said there was another topic you wanted to speak to. After,
I don't think so.
Okay.
No, I think I got to it already.
Okay, good. I wanted to ask you, in terms of, as we kind of wind down to the end of the hour, what do you do to kind of restore yourself? What do you do to get a sense of balance? What do you do physically, emotionally, intellectually? What do you do daily, weekly, monthly? How do you kind of keep your boat
hard
floating?
To say? Well, one thing is, I put some physical activity into my life, mm-hmm, and I think that's important. We do not own a car, and that means that all errands and all shopping is done. I do most of our grocery shopping on foot with a backpack,
mm-hmm,
and it is time-consuming, but on the other hand, it is undoubtedly very physically good for me.
Yes, absolutely.
And I am also, at this point, trying to do all of our yard work without resorting to machines.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The yard's a bit of a mess.
And is that a statement on your ability to pull it off without machines, or is that just the fact that the yard is overwhelming?
I think it's my inability to pull it off without machines.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps my failure to put quite enough time into it.
I have a garden. I have a yard where I've tried to eliminate grass. In terms of, so things are planted in permanent plantings. But with the rain that we've had this year, the weeds have just grown at a rate that I have never seen them, and I have never been so far behind in terms of. But if I could just accept the weeds as what reality is, then I wouldn't be in trouble at all. So you have built a lot of what I discovered along the way is I needed 12 to 16 hours a week of physical labor to feel like I was getting enough physical labor, uh-huh, in my life, and that's something that seems to hold pretty true for me. You seem to have worked it in your shopping and your gardening. And what are some of the other things you do to?
Well, I have throughout my time here, so for the last 40 years, I have always had one or two cats in the,
mm-hmm,
house,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and that, I don't know, that's a wonderful thing.
That's an experience of joy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, sorrow sometimes.
Well, that's true when they...
We've lost cats along, mm-hmm, the way.
Yeah.
One rather untimely, who was a voice on a few radio programs, by the way.
Wow. So, and what else?
Well, and of course, my ongoing relationship with my husband.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which, you know, very steady and always there, and he definitely takes care of me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you him, I can say.
Yes, yeah, that too.
Yeah, that's a mutual. I mean, it's the mutuality.
Yes.
As you were, it's the solidarity, even in a very intimate way. And I imagine that if you're shopping, you're also cooking, or does he cook?
No, he cooks. He cooks. I shop. He cooks. I wash the dishes.
Wow. Neat. Tell me, as we are winding down, we have time for one more song. What would you like to play of the songs that we have? We have The Solidarity Forever, Billy Bragg and the Internationale, and The Unwelcome Guest.
Let's play The Unwelcome Guest.
And can you introduce that?
Yes. Well, the words are by Woody Guthrie. Mm-hmm. The song is sung by Billy Bragg, part of a large... He was invited at one point to turn a lot of Woody Guthrie's words into heritage songs. Mm-hmm. But there's more resonance than that. And it's just a song that really gets to me. Mm-hmm. But also, it's the song that Lynn Gary used as her theme song on her radio program, which she also called The Unwelcome Guests. It was, as I recall, recorded interviews and a lot of recorded talks, and went for quite a few years on WEOS, and actually I think it was syndicated. And she was also instrumental in the early years of WRFI before it actually became a living radio station.
Before it came off the ground. Excellent. Teresa, it has been delightful to get to know you. And we're going to close with the Unwelcome Guest. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. Go riding in the damp, foggy midnight. You snort my good pony and you give me your best. For you know and I know, good horse amongst the rich ones, how oft time
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and that concludes the Made of Clay report.